Blog Talk Radio.
we've got here is failure to communicate. Some men you just can't reach. So you get what we had here last week, which is the way you want. Well, I don't like it.
So many people out there fail not because they don't have the ability. It's because they don't have the heart to go through adversity.
The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it.
You'll go through some failures.
When you're in that darkness, you want to sit there and wait for the light to come. But you can't wait. The only way out is to step forward, to face your fears, to become your own light. There's going to be a lot of times y'all about to fail. We are all a work in progress. But in that moment, I want you to remember the power of you. You will change the world.
Even when you're struggling, even when you're discouraged, and you feel like other people have given up on you, don't ever give up on yourself.
The indomitable will, if you have a belief, you can do something. The only way you grow that, like in the gym, you grow your muscles by actually exercising them. To grow the individual will to become something, you must get comfortable with fear and failure. They must be your best friends. They're the only one that moves that needle of life. Every hero you guys had was called an idiot, crazy, a loser. You must break society's status quo. Status quo is normality. It's alive but not living. It's death on a stick, guys. The belief of the individual overrides thousands of people with just intent. Safety, comfort zones are dead zones. You have to continue to push yourself because your true potential will never be matched, guys.
Nobody is going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. Now, if you know what you're worth, then go out and get what you're worth. But you got to be willing to take the hits.
The future rewards those who press on. With patient and firm determination, I'm going to press on. I don't have time to feel sorry for myself. I don't have time to complain. I'm going to press on. Stop complaining. Stop crying. We are going to press on. We've got work to do.
What's your why? What motivates you? What pushes you? What drives you? And if that thing is internal, if nobody has to call you, if nobody has to prod you, if nobody has to reward you, if nobody has to give you anything, if you are self-motivated and self-regulated, you can have it. You can be it. You can do it.
Take ownership. Take extreme ownership. Don't make excuses. Don't blame any other person or any other thing. Get control of your ego. Take ownership of everything in your world, the good and the bad. Take ownership of your mistakes. Take ownership of your shortfalls. Take ownership of your problems. And then take ownership of the solutions that will get those problems solved. Take ownership of your mission. Take ownership of your job, of your team, of your future, and take ownership of your life and lead to victory.
It's possible you can live your dream. It's necessary that you have a plan of action, that you're resilient, that you stick to, and you work with the system, that you have the vision and never give up, that you become creative and relentless and keep on coming back again and again and again, and that it's you that you've got to take personal responsibility to make it happen, and that it's hard. Easy is not an option. And when life knocks you down, jump back up and say, it's not over until I win.
We have, as humans, we have something that no animal has. And what it's called is imagination. And what imagination allows you to do, it allows you to see it before it actually happens. What I mean by that is I need you to go 10 years into the future, 20 years into the future, and I need you to see yourself actually becoming the person you want to be. You got to live in the forward. Block the whole world out. Put some music on, some classical music, right? The piano if you need to. I don't know what you need to listen to, but I want you to take 30 minutes. Go in the closet. Go in the basement. Go to the library. Go into a room alone. And I want you to take 30 minutes, and I want you to imagine. I want you to take 30 minutes, and I want you to live in the forward. See, the problem is, I'm talking to some of you guys, the problem that you're having is you're living in the future and you're living in the present. And you keep talking about the mistakes. You keep talking about the past. You keep talking about your trials. You keep talking about your situation. And I want you to know that everybody that's ever been great, everybody has had an obstacle to overcome. They've had a barrier that they had to climb. There is no individual who's ever reached success and he didn't have to go through an obstacle or a barrier to get there. I need you to live in the future. I need you to go in your future every single day. I need you to go in your future. I need you to see what you're going to be. Listen to me. What you are to be, you are now becoming. And so you got to use your imagination. And your imagination has to take you beyond the pain. Your imagination has to take you beyond the trouble. Your imagination has to take you to the next level. We had to see ourselves there long before it happened. The second tool is we got to embrace faith. I have to have faith to believe that the things that I see 10 years from now, 20 years from now, that one day that thing is going to be successful. When I was homeless at 16, I could have quit. When I was homeless, I could have given up. There are many a days that I thought about committing suicide, but I said to myself, E, just keep imagining, keep thinking, keep seeing what you're not now, but what you're going to be. Sometimes it's going to be hard. Sometimes you're going to look all around you and nowhere do you see success. Nowhere do you see anything that remotely looks like success, but you got to embrace. Number two, you got to embrace the faith. You got to believe that although it's not happening right now, if you keep pressing, if you keep pushing, guess what? One day is going to be your day. That's right. I need you to say that with me. One day is going to be your day. Embrace the faith. You got to be able to see it and believe it, that when there's no evidence around you, when there's no evidence around you, when you got pain in your life, when you're tired, you feel like giving up, and you feel like quit. When you look around you, you don't see anything that looks anything like success. You got to embrace the faith and believe that one day going to be my day. But one day can't be your day if you give up. If you quit, no day will ever be your day. I want you to fail forward. That's right, I said it, fail forward. I want you to get to a place in your life that every mistake you make, every setback you get, right, every obstacle that you don't that you don't overcome, every barrier you can't climb, I don't want you to give up, but I want you to fail forward. You got to learn from your mistakes, that every mistake you make, you fail a class, get back up and try again. You lose a job, get back up and try again. You put all your money in investment, get back and try it again. If you start a business and it don't work, don't stop, don't quit. Fail forward. Learn from each and every one of your mistakes.
All right, Joseph Gibson here, podcasting live, understanding the times in which you live today. I got one more here that actually was by request, so this one's only about a minute long. So for a couple military guys, I think, that are listening here tonight, they sent it to me. So I'll play that for them, and then we'll carry on with the podcast, understanding the times in which we live today. And the first two songs there in the beginning there, that was for my grandmother, who's listening live from the state of Connecticut, and that would be my son's great-grandmother, so my two sons' great-grandmother, so she's listening live. So I'll be right back here in about 1 minute, 52 seconds. Times which we live today. It's 7:20 p.m. on the East Coast here, Greensboro, North Carolina. If you missed the past couple shows there, we did a real good couple good ones there with the about George Washington. documentary on George Washington. Very good documentary. And the Andrew Jackson one was awesome. Really good. Last time we did Patton, too. That one didn't come out too well, but the audio was a little choppy, but you can still hear it. We did General Patton. So that was a good one there. Last night we did that one. So the past three podcasts, pretty good. I'd like to do the Money Masters right now. Talks a little bit about money and whatnot. That's what I'm probably going to do. But there's a couple stories here I want to get to. Again, those of you that are tuning in, the first two songs there. Usually I don't play rock and roll music, but my grandmother there wanted to listen to Oreo Speedwagon, so I had to put some Oreo Speedwagon on there. Ah, yeah, okay, there's a chat room there. There we go. All right, there, I see Sarge here. All right, yeah. Yeah, all right, Sarge, yes, sir. All right, let's see here. Okay, I'm getting messages now popping up on my other board here. But let me get to this story. This is important. The big brother here, with the big tech, Facebook is hub of sex recruitment, and the U.S. report says, CBS News reported the majority of online recruitment in active sex trafficking cases in the U.S. last year took place on Facebook. According to the Human Trafficking Institute's 2020 Federal Human Trafficking Report, the Internet has become the dominant tool that traffickers use to recruit victims, and they often recruit them on a number of very common social networking websites. Human Trafficking Institute CEO Victor Barutos said on CBSN Wednesday, Facebook overwhelmingly is used by traffickers to recruit victims to active sex trafficking cases. Active cases include those in which defendants were charged in 2020, as well as those in which defendants were charged in previous years and charges were still pending in trial last year, or the case was on appeal. Facebook faces antitrust investigations in Europe. Well, that ain't not going to amount to nothing. That's the next article there. Excuse me. All right, what do we got here? Big Pharma, COVID. Let's see. I got another article here. Most likely, what do we got here? There was one here I did want to put up. University vaccine mandates violate medical ethics and more. Very important information here I'm going to give you, so pay attention. This is very, very, very important. All right. University mandates violate medical ethics. Some 450 U.S. colleges and universities, including our institutions, have announced policies mandating that all students be fully vaccinated against COVID before the fall semester, with some requiring vaccination now for the summer term. Schools have for decades required vaccination, okay, against infectious diseases. But these mandates are unprecedented and unethical. Never before have colleges insisted that students or employees receive an experimental vaccine as a condition of attendance or employment. Even soldiers, whose rights are constrained when they join the service, aren't being compelled to take a COVID vaccine. In a case involving a vaccine against anthrax, a federal district court judge held in 2004 that the United States cannot demand that members of the armed forces also serve as guinea pigs for experimental drugs, absent informed consent or a presidential waiver of service member legal protections. The following year, the judge held that an emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration was insufficient to meet the legal test. U.S. college COVID vaccine mandates don't consider immunity or pregnancy and may run foul of the law. For Joshua Hauser, a junior at the University of California, Berkeley, the requirement to get a COVID-19 vaccine before fall semester is like getting a plum, a campus housing assignment. People are really excited about getting the vaccine on campus, he says. It will help us feel safe at school, and he's hopeful it will mean a return to normal. On Zoom, that's all we talk about. We just wish we were together in person. Beginning in late March, some U.S. colleges and universities began issuing requirements for students to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19 if they want to return to campus this autumn. Some policies include faculty and staff. What began as a handful of colleges soon turned into a dozens. By mid-April and to date, some 350 institutions have issued such policies, even though all three COVID vaccines available in the U.S. remain under emergency use authorization status, not approved. okay? Very important. Very, very important. Here we go. YouTube censors teachers for choice protest. Here we go. New York Teachers for Choice reported. YouTube has struck down the full video of the Teachers for Choice protest on June 12, 2021, in front of United Federation of Teachers. It got pulled down in less than 48 hours. The protest featured 11-year-old Jenna Miller, who was kicked out of school on June 8th for refusing to wear a mask in school, as well as many New York teachers speaking out against forced COVID vaccination. Forced in-school COVID testing vaccine, passports, and the masking of 4-year-old children. Oh, wow. Tech giants have to hand over your data when the federal investigators come and ask. Here's why. When the Trump administration's Justice Department sought to ferret out leakers, it turned to the tech giants, where so much of our digital life is stashed. Apple and Microsoft disclosed last week that the agency secretly subpoenaed account data from members of Congress and aides to crack down on leaks during the Trump administration. That followed recent disclosures to media organizations, including the Washington Post and the New York Times, that the Trump Justice Department had secretly sought reports, phone, and email records in an effort to identify the sources of leaks. That information, which email addresses and phone numbers we use, and we use them, can be crucial to piecing together a leak and a probe. COVID vaccine passports in the U.S. Here's what we're getting and why. Get ready, everybody. The European Union is about to launch a digital pass system that will let residents prove they have been vaccinated against COVID-19, recovered from the disease, or recently tested negative for the virus, allowing them to travel freely among all 27 member nations. Israelis use a similar digital pass system, showing their vaccination status to enter restaurants, gyms, and other venues. Australia has rolled out a digital proof of vaccination certificate, and Japan plans to issue one as soon as this summer. But don't expect the United States to go that way, right? Well, what are the roadblocks to a vaccine passport? Let's find out. With all American adults now eligible for COVID-19 vaccines, businesses and international borders reopening, a fierce debate has kicked off across the United States over whether a digital health certificate, often and somewhat misleading called a vaccine passport, should be required to prove immunization status. Currently, Americans are issued a white paper card as evidence of their COVID-19. But these can easily be forged, and online scammers are already selling false and stolen vaccine cards. Well, the government has said it will not introduce digital vaccine passports by federal mandate. A growing number of businesses, from cruise lines to sports venues, say they will require proof of vaccinations for entry or services. Hundreds of digital health pass initiatives are scrambling to launch apps that approve or provide a verified electronic record of immunizations and negative coronavirus test results to streamline the process. Well, folks, I don't know what to tell you. You know, you got to have vaccination, man. You got to have it, right? I mean, I don't care if it's been proven. I don't care if it hasn't been fully approved by the FDA. I don't care. I don't care. I want you vaccinated because I want to feel safe. Yeah. Yeah, right? Right now, right? I mean, I want to feel safe. That's it, period. So that means you have to give up your individual choice and liberty to make a choice because of me and all my friends behind me. I want to feel safe. Safe. Let's see. Was it not said? Those that sacrifice liberty for a little bit of security deserve neither. I believe that was Mr. Franklin that said that, right? Oh, those founders, how they get in the way of everything today, don't they? They just get right in our way, right in our face with those darn quotes, those powerful words. You know, the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. Every generation needs a revolution. Gave us a republic if we can keep it. All those silly words, you know, all those quotes, man. You know, I tell you what, we are really towards a tyrannical one system, one government, one world order. And like I said 15, 20 years ago, when people were calling me crazy, when I was talking about the same stuff that I'm talking about right now, just different types of stories, they were calling me crazy. This is going to be what's going to happen. The people will not be forced upon you. The people will demand it. They will want it. They will need it. They will beg for it. Save me. Help me, government. I don't care. I will give up my guns. I will give up everything. I will give up my free speech. I will give up everything I have. Even my children, because I already have when they were born, when I signed the birth certificate. I will give up everything just to live. To have that little bit of life. I will give up eternity of bliss in heaven because this life is what I want. I want here and now, right? That's what it's all about. That's what it's all about. Have an Amazon device? The tech giant may help itself to your Wi-Fi. Here we go. Do you own an Amazon smart device? If so, odds are good that the company is already sharing your internet connection with your neighbors unless you specifically told it not to. On Tuesday, the company launched a program that forces users of many Echo Smart speakers and Ring security cameras to automatically share a small portion of their home wireless bandwidth with neighbors. The only way to stop it is to turn off yourself. Amazon says the program called Amazon Sidewalk is a way to make sure lights, smart locks, and other gadgets outside the home and out of reach of a Wi-Fi connection stay working. But some experts warn that the technology is so new that privacy and security risks remain unclear. I mean, what the heck? We don't really need that stuff anyway, right? What the hell does the Fourth Amendment mean? And almost no one seems happy that Amazon forced consumers into Amazon Sidewalk, or that many people may not know they can opt out of it. Well, who the hell reads all that fine print anyway, right? India and tech companies clash over censorship, privacy, and digital colonialism. One night last month, police crowded into the lobby of Twitter's offices in India's capital, New Delhi. They were from an elite squad that normally investigates terrorism and organized crime, and said they were trying to deliver a notice alerting Twitter to misinformation allegedly tweeted by opposition politicians. But they arrived at 8 p.m. and Twitter's offices were closed anyway, under a coronavirus lockdown. It's unclear if they ever managed to deliver their notice. Excuse me. They released video of their raid afterward to the Indian TV channels, and footage shows them negotiating with security guards in the lobby. The May 24th police raid, which Twitter later called an intimidation tactic, was one of the latest salvos in a confrontation between the Indian government and social media companies over what online content gets investigated or blocked and who gets to decide. Yeah, man, it's getting crazy. It's really going crazy out there. But, you know, this is what we've marched ourselves right into. Why? Why? Because of that money. We are all chasing that dollar bill. Money. That's what it's all about, right? All right, hang on. I got to see. Joe, you should know that you should disregard anything that those. Yeah, we got to disregard those racist founders. Those guys were just racist, all of them. I mean, for goodness sake, it's outdated, the Constitution, just like the Bible. Men wrote that thing, and you know what? Who can really believe it's real or not, you know? I mean, none of us were around back then. I mean, you know, how do we know what George really said? I mean, come on. Was the guy even for real? I mean, right, he had wooden teeth. That's what they were saying. What one girl called in the other night, they were making fun of him about his teeth, you know? Who cares? Why slander the guy? Why even make fun of him? Why say something silly like that? How about talking about what he really stood for? Friends with all, alliances with none. All his policies and what he did. George Washington. One of the greatest, like Sarge says there in the chat room there, one of the greatest Americans, if not the greatest American, that ever walked in this country at one time or another and throughout the history of what we now call America. George Washington, a great patriot, a leader, and I would say Andrew Jackson, he's probably number two on my list. I mean, Andrew Jackson was just a very, very, that guy didn't take nothing. You know, you had a problem with him, he challenged you to a duel. That's it. The guy walked around with a bullet in his chest, you know? I mean, he was something else, Andrew Jackson. But, you know, we're in big trouble here. I mean, they're deeming us all terrorists. I mean, we have no rights anymore. It's just insane. I mean, we have the rights there, but we're just not using them. We're enforcing them, and we just don't know how. So, with that being said, I'm going to try playing a little bit of the Money Masters here. And I won't play too much of it, but I'll play a little bit of it, see how the audio goes for a little bit, see if it clears up. I mean, this is the reason why we're really, really in a jam. The Federal Reserve Banking Cartel and the Central Banking Scheme. And this really breaks it down. It's a good documentary. It gives it in simplistic terms. We'll see how the audio goes. We'll go with that. Whoa, hang on a second here. We've got to fix that. Might not be able to play this. Hang on. Let's shut this down here. Live radio, what do you expect? Here we go. Let's see. All right, there we go. All right, be back here in a few minutes. We'll just play this and see how this goes, and then open up the phone boards. Anybody wants to talk here tonight? I kicked off during the intro here tonight about five of you. I've been doing that lately. The people that are trying to hack into the show with the nonsense, I've gotten so many good positive reviews now that they're gone. So I'm trying to keep them off. You know, and they've gone away. I don't need content with their, you know. Look, this is serious business what we're up against here. We're fighting for our freedom. You know, we're trying to do it lawfully, and we're trying to wake people up and make them understand what's really going on out there. And Understanding the Times in Which We Live Today is a perfect title to the days in which we live today, and that's the name of the podcast. So 657-383-0616 is the phone number. Press number one, and I'll get you on.
Neither Federal has got the reserves. It's a private bank that is owned by member banks. And it was chartered under the guise of deceit by an act of Congress in 1913. If there's still any doubt whether the Federal Reserve is a part of the U.S. government, check your local telephone book. In most cities, it is not listed in the blue government pages. It is listed in the business white pages right next to Federal Express, another private company. But more directly, U.S. courts have ruled time and time again that the Fed is a private corporation. Why can't Congress do something about the Fed? Most members of Congress just don't understand the system, and the few who do are afraid to speak up. For example, initially, a veteran congressman from Chicago asked us if he could be interviewed for this video. However, both times our camera crew arrived at his office to do the interview, this was all we were able to film. The congressman never appeared and eventually decided he no longer wanted to participate. But a few others in Congress have been bolder over the years. Here are three quick examples. In 1923, Representative Charles A. Lindbergh, a Republican from Minnesota, and father of the famed aviator Lucky Lindy, put it this way: the financial system has been turned over to the Federal Reserve Board. That board administers the finance system by authority of a purely profiteering group. The system is private, conducted for the sole purpose of obtaining the greatest possible profits from the use of other people's money. One of the most outspoken critics in Congress of the Fed was the former chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee during the Great Depression years. Louis T. McFadden, Republican of Pennsylvania, said in 1932, "We have in this country one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known. I refer to the Federal Reserve Board. This evil institution has impoverished the people of the United States and has practically bankrupted our government. It has done this through the corrupt practices of the moneyed vultures who control it." Senator Barry Goldwater was a frequent critic of the Fed. "Most Americans have no real understanding of the operation of the international moneylenders. The accounts of the Federal Reserve System have never been audited. It operates outside the control of Congress and manipulates the credit of the United States." The Federal Reserve really, even though it is not part of the federal government, is more powerful than the federal government. It's more powerful than the president, the Congress, and the courts. Now, a lot of people challenge me on that, but let me prove my case. The Federal Reserve determines what the average person's car payment is going to be, what their house payment is going to be, and whether they have a job or not. And I submit to you that that's total control. And the Federal Reserve is the largest single creditor of the United States government. But as Proverbs tell us, the borrower is servant to the lender.
What one has to understand is that from the day the Constitution was adopted right up to today, the folks who profit from privately owned central banks, as Madison called them, the money changers, have fought a running battle for control over who gets to print America's money. Why is who prints the money so important? Think of money as just another commodity. If you have a monopoly on a commodity that everyone needs, everyone wants, and nobody has enough of, there are lots of ways to make a profit and also exert tremendous political influence. That's what this battle is all about. Throughout the history of the United States, the money power has gone back and forth between Congress and some sort of privately owned central bank. The founding fathers knew the evils of a privately owned central bank. First of all, they had seen how the privately owned British central bank, the Bank of England, had run up the British national debt to such an extent that Parliament had been forced to place unfair taxes on the American colonies. In fact, as we'll see later, Ben Franklin claimed that this was the real cause of the American Revolution. Most of the founding fathers realized the potential dangers of banking and feared bankers' accumulation of wealth and power. Jefferson put it this way:
I sincerely believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs.
That succinct statement of Jefferson is, in fact, the solution to all our economic problems today. It bears repeating. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs. James Madison, the main author of the Constitution, agreed. Interestingly, he called those behind the central bank scheme money changers. Madison strongly criticized their actions.
History records that the money changers have used every form of abuse, intrigue, deceit, and violent means possible to maintain their control over governments by controlling money and its issuance.
The battle over who gets to issue our money has been the pivotal issue throughout the history of the United States. Wars are fought over it, depressions are caused to acquire it. Yet after World War I, this battle was rarely mentioned in newspapers or history books. Why? By World War I, the money changers, with their dominant wealth, had seized control of most of the nation's press. Throughout U.S. history, this battle over who gets the power to issue our money has raged. In fact, it's changed hands back and forth eight times since 1764. Yet this fact has virtually vanished from public view for over three generations behind a smokescreen emitted by Fed cheerleaders in the media. Until we stop talking about deficit and government spending and start talking about who controls how much money we have, it's all just a big shell game, a complete and utter deception. It won't matter if you pass an ironclad amendment to the Constitution mandating a balanced budget. Our situation is only going to get worse until we root out the cause at its source. What's the solution for our national problem? First of all, education. That's what this presentation is all about. But secondly, we must act. We must take back the power to issue our own money. Issuing our own money is not a radical solution. I want to stress that. It's the same solution used at different points in U.S. history by men like Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Martin Van Buren, and Abraham Lincoln. So, to sum it up, in 1913, Congress gave an independent central bank, deceptively named the Federal Reserve, a monopoly over issuing America's money. And the debt generated by this quasi-private operation is what is killing the American economy. So the Federal Reserve is now the most powerful central bank in the world. It was not the first. So where did this idea come from? To really understand the magnitude of the problem, we have to travel back to Europe.
who are these money changers James Madison spoke of? In the Bible, 2,000 years ago, Jesus drove the money changers from the temple. It was the only time Jesus used force during his ministry. What were money changers doing in the temple? When Jews came to Jerusalem to pay their temple tax, they could only pay it with a special coin, the half shekel of the sanctuary. This was a half ounce of pure silver about this size. It was the only coin around at that time which was pure silver and of assured weight without the image of a pagan emperor. Therefore, to Jews, the half shekel was the only coin acceptable to God. But these coins were not plentiful. The money changers had cornered the market on them. Then they raised the price, just like any other commodity, to whatever the market would bear. In other words, money changers were making exorbitant profits because they held a virtual monopoly on money. The Jews had to pay whatever they demanded. To Jesus, this totally violated the sanctity of God's house. But the money-changing scam did not originate in Jesus' day. 200 years before Christ, Rome was having trouble with money changers. Two early Roman emperors had tried to diminish the power of the money changers by reforming usury laws and limiting land ownership to 500 acres. They were both assassinated. In 48 B.C., Julius Caesar took the power to coin money from the money changers and minted coins for the benefit of all. With this new, plentiful supply of money, he built great public works projects. By making money plentiful, Caesar won the love of the common man. But the money changers hated him. Some believe this was an important factor in Caesar's assassination. One thing is for sure, with the death of Caesar came the demise of plentiful money in Rome. Taxes increased, as did corruption. Just as in the case of America today, usury and debased coin became the rule. Eventually, the Roman money supply was reduced by 90%. As a result, the common people lost their lands and their homes, just as is about to happen soon in America. With the demise of plentiful money, masses lost confidence in the Roman government and refused to support it. Rome plunged into the gloom of the Dark Ages. A thousand years after the death of Christ, money changers, those who loan out and manipulate the quantity of money, were active in medieval England. In fact, they were so active that acting together, they could manipulate the entire English economy. These were not bankers per se. The money changers generally were the goldsmiths. They were the first bankers because they started keeping other people's gold for safekeeping in their vaults. The first paper money was merely a receipt for gold left at the goldsmith. Paper money caught on because it was more convenient than carrying around a lot of heavy gold and silver coins. Eventually, goldsmiths noticed that only a small fraction of the depositors ever came in and demanded their gold at any one time. Goldsmiths started cheating on the system. They discovered that they could print more money than they had gold, and usually no one would be the wiser. Then they could loan out this extra money and collect interest on it. This was the birth of fractional reserve banking, that is, loaning out many times more money than you have assets on deposit. So, if $1,000 in gold were deposited with them, they could loan out about $10,000 in paper money and draw interest payments on it, and no one would ever discover the deception. By this means, goldsmiths gradually accumulated more and more wealth and used this wealth to accumulate more and more gold. Today, this practice of loaning out more money than there are reserves is known as fractional reserve banking. Every bank in the United States is allowed to loan out at least 10 times more money than they actually have. That's why they get rich on charging, let's say, 8% interest. It's not really 8% per year, which is their income. It's 80%. That's why bank buildings are always the largest in town. But does that mean that all interest or all banking should be illegal? Hardly. In the Middle Ages, canon law, the law of the Catholic Church, forbade charging interest on loans. This concept followed the teaching of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas. They taught that the purpose of money was to serve the members of society, to facilitate the exchange of goods needed to lead a virtuous life. Interest, in their belief, hindered this purpose by putting an unnecessary burden on the use of money. In other words, interest was contrary to reason and justice. Reflecting church law in the Middle Ages, Europe forbade charging interest on loans and made it a crime called usury. As commerce grew, and therefore opportunities for investment arose in the late Middle Ages, it came to be recognized that to loan money had a cost for the lender, both in risk and in lost opportunity. So some charges were allowed, but not interest per se. But all moralists, no matter what religion, condemn fraud, oppression of the poor, and injustice as clearly immoral. As we will see, fractional reserve lending is rooted in a fraud, results in widespread poverty, and reduces the value of everyone else's money. The ancient goldsmiths discovered that extra profits could be made by rowing the economy between easy money and tight money. When they made money easier to borrow, then the amount of money in circulation expanded. Money was plentiful. People took out more loans to expand their businesses. But then the money changers would tighten the money supply. They would make loans more difficult to get. What would happen? Just what happens today. A certain percentage of people could not repay their previous loans and could not take out new loans to repay the old ones. Therefore, they went bankrupt and had to sell their assets to the goldsmiths for pennies on the dollar. The same thing is still going on today. Only today, we call this rowing of the economy up and down the business cycle. Like Julius Caesar, King Henry I of England finally resolved to take the money power away from the goldsmiths about 1100 AD. Henry could have used anything as money, seashells, feathers, or even yak dung, as is often done in remote Tibetan provinces. But he invented one of the most unusual money systems in history. It was called the tally stick system. Here I have one of the few surviving examples of this form of British money, which lasted 726 years until 1826, a tally stick. The tally system was adopted to avoid the monetary manipulation of the goldsmiths. Tally sticks were money fabricated out of sticks of polished wood. Notches were cut along one edge of the stick to indicate the denominations. Then the stick was split lengthwise through the notches so that both pieces still had a record of the notches. The king kept one half to protect against counterfeiting. Then he would spend the other half into the economy and they would circulate as money. This particular tally stick is huge. It represented 25,000 pounds. One of the original stockholders in the Bank of England purchased his original shares with this stick. In other words, he bought shares in the world's richest and most powerful corporation with a stick of wood. It's ironic that after its formation in 1694, the Bank of England attacked the tally stick system because it was money outside the power of the money changers, just as King Henry had wanted it to be. Why do people accept sticks of wood for money? That's a great question. Throughout history, people traded anything they thought had value and used as money. You see, the secret is that money is only what people agree on to use as money. What's our paper money today? It's really just paper. But here's the trick. King Henry ordered that tally sticks had to be used to pay the king's taxes. This built-in demand for tally sticks immediately made them circulate and be accepted as money. And they worked well. In fact, no other form of money has worked so well for so long as tally sticks. Keep in mind, the British Empire was built under the tally stick system. The tally stick system succeeded despite the fact that the money changers constantly attacked it by offering the metal coin system as competition. In other words, metal coins never went completely out of circulation, but tally sticks hung on because they were good for the payment of taxes. Finally, in the 1500s, King Henry VIII relaxed the laws concerning usury, and the money changers wasted no time reasserting themselves. They quickly made their gold and silver money plentiful for a few decades. But when Queen Mary took the throne and tightened the usury laws again, the money changers renewed the hoarding of gold and silver coins, forcing the economy to plummet. When Queen Mary's sister, Queen Elizabeth I, took the throne, she was determined to regain control over English money. Her solution was to issue gold and silver coins from the public treasury and take the control over the money supply away from the money changers. Although control over money was not the only cause of the English Revolution in 1642, religious differences fueled the conflict, monetary policy played a major role. Financed by the money changers, Oliver Cromwell finally overthrew King Charles, purged the Parliament, and put the king to death. The money changers were immediately allowed to consolidate their financial power. The result was that for the next 50 years, the money changers plunged Great Britain into a series of costly wars. They took over a square mile of property in the center of London, known as the City of London. This area today is still known as one of the three predominant financial centers of the world. Conflicts with the Stuart kings led the money changers in England to combine with those in the Netherlands to finance the invasion of William of Orange, who overthrew the Stuarts in 1688 and took the English throne. By the end of the 1600s, England was in financial ruin. 50 years of more or less continuous wars with France and Holland had exhausted her. Frantic government officials met with the money changers to beg for the loans necessary to pursue their political purposes. The price was high, a government-sanctioned, privately owned bank which could issue money created out of nothing. It was to be the modern world's first privately owned central bank, the Bank of England. Although it was deceptively called the Bank of England to make the general population think it was part of the government, it was not. Like any other private corporation, the Bank of England sold shares to get started. The investors, whose names were never revealed, were supposed to put up 1.25 million British pounds in gold coin to buy their shares in the bank, but only 750,000 pounds was ever received. Despite that, the bank was duly chartered in 1694 and started out in the business of loaning out several times the money it supposedly had in reserves, all at interest. In exchange, the new bank would loan British politicians as much of the new currency as they wanted, as long as they secured the debt by direct taxation of the British people. So, legalization of the Bank of England amounted to nothing less than legal counterfeiting of a national currency for private gain. Unfortunately, nearly every nation now has a privately controlled central bank using the Bank of England as the basic model. Such is the power of these central banks that they soon take total control over a nation's economy. It soon amounts to nothing but a plutocracy ruled by the rich. It would be like putting control of the army in the hands of the mafia. The danger of tyranny would be extreme. Yes, we need central banks. No, we do not need them in private hands. The central bank scam is really a hidden tax. The nation sells bonds to the central bank to pay for things it does not have the political will to raise taxes to pay for. But the bonds are purchased with money the central bank creates out of nothing. More money in circulation makes your money worth less. The government gets as much money as it needs, and the people pay for it in inflation. The beauty of the plan is that not one person in a thousand can figure it out, because it's usually hidden behind complex-sounding economics gibberish. With the formation of the Bank of England, the nation was soon awash in money. Prices throughout the country doubled. Massive loans were granted for just about any wild scheme. One venture proposed to drain the Red Sea to recover gold supposedly lost when the Egyptian army drowned pursuing Moses and the Israelites. By 1698, government debt grew from the initial £1.25 million to £16 million. Naturally, taxes were increased and then again to pay for all of this. With the British money supply firmly in their grip, the British economy began a wild roller coaster series of booms and depressions, exactly the sort of thing a central bank claims it is determined to prevent.
There are two things which I think are intrinsic not just to the Bank of England, but the central bank in general. The first is an involvement in the formulation of monetary policy with the specific objective of achieving monetary stability.
However, since the Bank of England took control, the British pound has rarely been stable. Now let's take a look at the role of the Rothschild family, the family said to be the wealthiest in the world. This is Frankfurt, Germany. 15 years after the Bank of England opened its doors, a goldsmith named Amschel Moses Bauer opened a coin shop, a counting house, in 1743. And over the door, he placed a sign depicting a Roman eagle on a red shield. The shop became known as the Red Shield Firm, or in German, Rothschild. When his son, Amschel Meyer Bauer, inherited the business, he decided to change his name to Rothschild. Amschel soon learned that loaning money to governments and kings was more profitable than loaning to private individuals. Not only were the loans bigger, but they were secured by the nation's taxes. Mayor Rothschild had five sons. He trained all in the skills of money creation, then sent them out to the major capitals of Europe to open branch offices of the family banking business. His first son, Amschel Meyer, stayed in Frankfurt to mine the hometown bank. His second son, Solomon, was sent to Vienna. His third son, Solomon, was clearly the most clever. He was sent to London at age 21 in 1798, 100 years after the founding of the Bank of England. His fourth son, Carl, went to Naples, and his fifth son, Jacob, went to Paris. In 1785, Mayor Amschel moved his entire family to this larger house, a five-story dwelling he shared with the Schiff family. This house was known as the Green Shield. The Rothschilds and the Schiffs would play a central role in the rest of European financial history and in that of the United States. The Rothschilds broke into dealings with European royalty here at Wilhelmshof, the palace of the wealthiest man in Germany, in fact, the wealthiest monarch in all Europe, Prince William of Hesse-Cassel. At first, the Rothschilds were only helping William speculate in precious coins. But when Napoleon chased Prince William into exile, he sent £550,000, a gigantic sum at that time, to Nathan Rothschild in London with instructions for him to buy consols, British government bonds, also called government stock. But Rothschild used the money for his own purposes. With Napoleon on the loose, the opportunities of wartime investment were nearly limitless. William returned here sometime prior to the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. He summoned Rothschild and demanded his money back. The Rothschilds returned William's money with the interest the British consuls would have paid him had the investment actually been made. But the Rothschilds kept all the past profits they had made using Will's money. Nathan Rothschild later bragged that in the 17 years he'd been in England, he'd increased his original 20,000-pound stake given to him by his father by 2,500 times. By cooperating within the family, the Rothschilds soon grew unbelievably wealthy. By the mid-1800s, they dominated all European banking and were certainly the wealthiest family in the world. They financed Cecil Rhodes, making it possible for him to establish a monopoly over the diamond and gold fields of South Africa. In America, they financed the Harrimans and railroads, the Vanderbilt railroads and the press, and Carnegie in the steel industry, among many others. In fact, during World War I, J.P. Morgan was thought to be the richest man in America. But after his death, it was discovered that he was actually only a lieutenant of the Rothschilds. Once Morgan's will was made public, it was discovered that he owned only 19% of J.P. Morgan companies. By 1850, James Rothschild, the heir of the French branch of the family, was said to be worth 600 million French francs, 150 million more than all the other bankers in France put together. He built this mansion called Ferrier, just east of Paris. Wilhelm I, on seeing it, exclaimed, "Kings couldn't afford this. It could only belong to a Rothschild." Another 19th century French commentator put it this way: "There is but one power in Europe, and that is Rothschild. There is no evidence that their predominant standing in European or world finance has changed." Now let's take a look at the results the Bank of England had produced on the British economy and how that later was the root cause of the American Revolution. By the mid-1700s, the British Empire was nearing its height of power around the world. But Britain had fought four costly wars in Europe since the creation of their privately owned central bank, the Bank of England. The cost had been high. To finance these wars, the British Parliament here had borrowed heavily from the bank. By the mid-1700s, the government's debt here in Britain was 140 million pounds, a staggering sum for those days. Consequently, the British government embarked on a program of trying to raise revenues from their American colonies in order to make their interest payments to the bank. But in America, it was a different story. The scourge of a privately owned central bank had not yet hit. This is Independence Hall in Philadelphia, where the Declaration of Independence and Constitution were signed. In the mid-1700s, pre-revolutionary America was still relatively poor. There was a severe shortage of precious metal coins to trade for goods, so the early colonists were forced to experiment with printing their own homegrown paper money. Some of these experiments were successful. Franklin was a big supporter of the colonies printing their own paper money. In 1757, Franklin was sent to London. He ended up staying for the next 18 years here, nearly until the start of the American Revolution. During this period, the American colonies began to issue their own money. Called colonial scrip, the endeavor was very successful. It provided a reliable medium of exchange, and it also helped to provide a feeling of unity between the colonies. Remember, colonial scrip was just paper money, debt-free money printed in the public interest and not backed by gold or silver coin. In other words, it was a totally fiat currency. One day, officials of the Bank of England asked Franklin how he would account for the newfound prosperity of the colonies. Without hesitation, he replied,
"That is simple. In the colonies, we issue our own money. It is called colonial scrip. We issue it in proper proportion to the demands of trade and industry to make the product pass easily from the producers to the consumers. In this manner, creating for ourselves our own paper money, we control its purchasing power, and we have no interest to pay to no one
This was just common sense for Franklin, but you can imagine the impact it had on the Bank of England. America had learned the secret of money, and that genie had to be returned to its bottle as soon as possible.
To himself and his friends to reinvest
in shares of the bank. And, like the Bank of England, the bank was given a monopoly over the national currency. Soon the dangers became clear. The value of American currency continued to plummet. So, 4 years later, in 1785, the bank's charter was not renewed. The leader of the effort to kill the bank, William Findlay of Pennsylvania, explained the problem this way, quote, "This institution, having no principle but that of avarice, will never be varied in its object to engross all the wealth, power, and influence of the state." The men behind the Bank of North America, Alexander Hamilton, Robert Morris, and the bank's president, Thomas Wiling, did not give up. Only 6 years later, Hamilton, then Secretary of the Treasury, and his mentor, Morris, rammed a new privately owned central bank through the new Congress. Called the First Bank of the United States, Thomas Wiling again served as the bank's president. The players were the same, only the name of the bank was changed. In 1787, colonial leaders assembled in Philadelphia to replace the ailing Articles of Confederation. As we saw earlier, both Thomas Jefferson and James Madison were unalterably opposed to a privately owned central bank. They had seen the problems caused by the Bank of England. They wanted nothing of it. As Jefferson later put it, "If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations which grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered." During the debate over the future monetary system, another one of the founding fathers, Gouverneur Morris, castigated the motivations of the owners of the Bank of North America. Gouverneur Morris headed the committee that wrote the final draft of the Constitution. Morris knew the motivations of the bank well. Along with his old boss, Robert Morris, Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton were the ones who had presented the original plan for the North America to the Continental Congress in the last year of the Revolution. In a letter he wrote to James Madison on July 2, 1787, Gouverneur Morris revealed what was really going on.
"The rich will strive to establish their dominion and enslave the rest. They always did. They always will. They will have the same effect here as elsewhere if we do not, by the power of government, keep them in their proper spheres."
Despite the defection of Gouverneur Morris from the ranks of the bank, Hamilton, Robert Morris, Thomas Wiling, and their European backers were not about to give up. They convinced the bulk of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention to not give Congress the power to issue paper money. Most of the delegates were still reeling from the wild inflation of the paper currency during the Revolution. They had forgotten how well colonial scrip had worked before the war. But the Bank of England had not. The money changers could not stand to have America printing her own money again. So the Constitution is silent on the matter. This grievous defect left the door wide open for the money changers, just as they had planned.
All right, everybody. All right, all right. Joseph Gibson podcasting here, Understanding the Times. We'll leave that right there. It's a long documentary, of course, but you learn banking, and you learn about the banking system. You learn about money. You learn about how you're getting screwed over by the banks, and that's just the way it operates. That's what it's all about. That's the Money Masters right there. We'll continue the documentary tomorrow night. We'll be a two-part series, obviously, because it's a long documentary. But the Money Masters, and we are live here, Understanding the Times in Which We Live Today. And it's a very, very intrinsic system of the financial market. Look, we live in the times of deception today. that you can't trust anybody, everybody's out to get you. I mean, there's who can you really trust? You lay a $100 bill down on the ground, somebody will take it, nobody will turn it in, they'll take it. Finders keepers, losers weepers. You hear the silence? There's no honesty. There's nothing anymore. And it's getting worse. It really is. I mean, if you're in the business community out there, you know for sure that it's always been rough, but there, at least there was, you shook somebody's hand. You had some sort of code of honor. You know, I watch your back, you watch my back, even in the field. You know, in the field, you watch my, I watch your back, you watch my back, you know. And let me turn this off here. Hang on, sorry. Live radio. There's no honesty. There's no integrity anymore. I mean, I don't know how it is. How is it in the military now? I talk to military guys, and even they say now it's dirty. You know, I mean, there's still an ethical conduct. I mean, there's rules of engagement. There's rules all, but look at what happened in Libya, Benghazi. Look at that. That right there was such a detrimental blow to our armed services. Well, I mean, Hillary Clinton, right? To the Clintons, really, when Bill Clinton was elected president, that was the downfall of reality, I would say, for America. That was really the downfall. People say, well, look at JFK. No. Listen, John F. Kennedy, the media was working on it back then, but I'm saying, really, when you dishonor the Oval Office like Bill Clinton did, and the Clinton Foundation, and they're just responsible for murders. I mean, Hillary Clinton, why is she not in prison? If you or I did one email scandal like she did, we would have a felony conviction. This woman right now, there should be in prison. She's not. So how do you expect everyone else to, be okay with this, how the system works? I mean, there's no justice. And I kind of have to agree with the Black Lives Matter movement in a lot of ways when it comes to that, where no justice, no peace. That's it. Period. Now, I don't agree with burning down small business owners' buildings. What did they do? It's not them. They didn't do anything. They're victims just like us. But, go after these guys, the bankers, Wall Street. You want to go after somebody, you don't go after the China men that's on the China woman that's on the corner there waiting for the bus. She didn't do nothing. Come on. And that's the ignorance, though. That's the violent tendencies of people that we don't need. That's because there's no morality. If you would have had something that happened 150 years ago, Benghazi, something like that, or a Clinton scandal, or disrespect in the Oval Office. Look, we played the documentaries earlier on in the week, the George Washington, Andrew Jackson, the documentaries. These were men of character, their wives of character. They had character, just let alone a rumor of them cheating on their husband, they would commit suicide because they wouldn't want to, it was disgusting, You had your word meant something. I just don't know how else to put it. Today, a handshake means nothing. Your word means nothing. It really doesn't really mean anything anymore. People still follow through just because, but your word really doesn't mean anything anymore. You have to have all these. That's why I have so many contracts. That's the way the system is. And this is what we want in our world, right? We this is what we want. We want. It's all about me. Myself and I, right? Me, myself, and I. The Facebook. What's Facebook all about? Selfies. What's a PC all about? PC. Personal computer. Right? Me. What was the greatest movie there with years ago? The Titanic. Remember that? That movie there? Everyone talking about the love story. That was the most filthy, rotten, disgusting, immoral story there was in the movie theaters. Some girl that's getting married or cheating on her fiance, and everybody's hyping it up. How could you Hollywood. Perversion through Hollywood. Hollywood has done it throughout the years, The stars. Be like the stars. What's the stars? The fallen stars. We get back into religion here on this. It's all part of it. This is a lot of things going on. You open your eyes and you'll see what's going on. 657-383-0616 is the phone number. We'll take my first caller here. Go ahead there, private caller.
Joe, you know something, man? I'm going to tell you something. Now, when I went in the Army, I took the AFQT. I scored 130 on it, which meant I was well above average intelligence. But, man, every time this Federal Reserve thing comes up, I get a headache trying to understand it. I've got The Creature from Jekyll Island, the fifth edition, which is supposed to be the best book ever written on the subject. I've read it twice, and I still don't quite understand it. But let me try to run it by you and see if this makes sense in my basic understanding of this. Now, in the past, when the federal government wanted to raise some money, the Treasury would sell government bonds, right? But
yes.
Recently, they've abandoned any pretense of selling bonds, and instead they just print more money. So my question is, if the Federal Reserve is just printing money, is the U.S. really borrowing it? And can we just print more money to pay back the money we already owe? And the scary thing is this, that once the government discovers that what it needs is more money and it can just print it, well, you know what it does, it does. They monetize the debt or they do quantitative easing. And the problem with that is you get runaway inflation, which will destroy your life savings unless you've got it invested in hard assets like gold, real estate, brass, copper jacketed lead, or Bitcoin or something. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah.
This thing always gives me a headache every time it comes up.
Well, when you have a lot of, it's an easy way to look at it.
It's important we understand it.
Well, it's an easy way to look at it. When you have so much of every something, it dilutes it. Like, for instance, say you're like orange juice. You take concentrate orange juice. You have to make 12 ounces of water to make it taste right. Well, if you put 32 ounces of water, you have more of it, but it's not as valued. It's not as good. It's the same thing with the money supply. As you pour more money, you have plentiful of it, but it's not as good. So that means prices go what? Up. Right, it's a reversal. They go up because people have to pay more to get the best of something. You see, you know. So it's I understand what you're saying. It's hard to wrap your. But as far as the bond market goes, the bonds are you. How many people are born every day? You look at your birth certificate. Your birth certificate is printed on bonded banking paper. Okay, if you have an origin of birth, your birth certificate, actual birth, not a certificate of birth, you know, you will never see that. You'll never see your origin of birth certificate, but you get a certificate of birth, it's just like a car. You don't have the origin of title. You have a certificate of title. So it's a copy. The real one is being held someplace else as collateral because you're not allowed to have that. You see, you have to really go into the 1933 Emergency Powers Act and go to House Resolution. I think it's 192. That was a good one to read. It's always like 2 pages long. That one explains it pretty good. And then you got the last Emergency Powers Act of 1973 or 76, I think it was. That explains it, too. I read it one time on the air. You know, people just don't understand is that you have to keep the money supply. See, it's all about digits, too, now. They're turning into digits. The paper money's going away. They're going to be, you know, and then what are they going to do when they turn it into digits? They're going to put it into a computer chip in your phone or in your, you know, because obviously everyone knows they're going to take a microchip in their right hand or their forehead, you know. I mean, you know, they're going to put that little chip in your phone, and what do you do? Yeah, what's everybody staring at today? Your phone. You know, it's buy or sell with our phone, so could that be the future mark of the beast, I guess you could say. You know, the globalist agenda is very, 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 very complex.
Man,
I mean,
look,
it's all about control, right?
Look,
it's all about control.
Yeah, look, it's another thing about this thing, too, that drives me crazy, according to my understanding of it. Now, look, if you want to borrow $100, the Fed will create the $100, okay? But then they want to get $105 in return. Now, where does that $5 interest payment come from? From the Fed. They'll be happy to create the additional $5 for you so you can pay them back the $105 you owe them. But then that means you got to borrow more from the Fed. It's like circular. It's like privately owned central banks, which depend on debt-driven economies and endless interest payments. Now, during the Civil War, the Lincoln administration printed what, Brother Joe?
Greenbacks.
Yep. Government-printed money created so you get liquidity in the marketplace. There wasn't no interest on it. You got $100,
right,
and you pay back $100. Nobody's getting rich off that transaction. But the economy gets fueled, and the economy functions. Now, look,
nowadays, though,
everything is dependent upon debt to cycle itself. I mean, this is just getting – Yeah, I understand it, and then I don't understand. You know
it's
what I
terrible.
Mean?
Debt-based system. It's a debt-based system. Why should we
yeah.
be serving? Well, you know, we're serfs. We're all serfs. That's why I say we're all the slaves to the slaves. You know, this is not freedom. You're not. You're a serf to the system. Money. That you know, you worship of money for the love of money for you know, as the root of all evil for the love of money. It doesn't say just because you have it. You know, but the thing of it is that. How do you get out of it? What kind of bartering system do you create? We have to have a bartering system.
I don't know
system.
How you can
everything
get out of it, Joe. Look, 54% of this year's deficit was provided by newly printed money. The Fed holds about $2.3 trillion in treasuries at the start of last year and about $4.5 trillion by the end of the year. And the debt held by the public went from just over $17 trillion to $21.45 trillion on the same day. How is it possible to get out of it? It isn't.
You can't. You could tax everybody 100% of their income for the next 10 years, and you still could not pay off the debt because you would just
isn't
you know because you're still going
to hear
the interest.
Stupid, moronic, imbecilic Democrats hogging us with class warfare by saying they're going to get it from rich people. They're insane.
Exactly.
Even rich people ain't got this much money.
Well, these are people that when you show them facts, like we always say, right? They still don't get it. It's like they're blinded by a veil of evil, you know? I mean, it's just weird. They say, but listen to this, Sarge. In the entire world, there's only $6 trillion. That's what they say, in U.S. dollars circulated in the entire world. So how should we owe $17
trillion? No, well, I know we owe $22 trillion, man. It's closing up on 22 trillion. There has never been that much money in the history of the planet since the beginning of money, since Genghis Khan came up with paper money.
And there's only 36 trillion of all entire and money altogether in all currencies around the world that the central banks print, you know, that have control of. So there's only 36 trillion in the entire world. So how
do
we hold 20
of
it?
I get so sick of hearing these. If you took every single dime, not just tax them at a higher rate, you take every single asset and penny that Jeff Bezos and Zuckerberg and Oprah Winfrey and the Queen of England and anybody you could think of that's wealthy, you barely make a dent in this debt.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
They do it, I think, in order to just get the hoi polloi to say, hey, look what we're doing. We're going to take more. We're going to do for you by taking more money from that guy over there. And you're supposed to fall for that.
I know. Yeah. That's what it is. And you really, though, people say, well, what about a world where everything is free? Then you'll have nobody want. Then you're just going to have immorality. There'll be no control. You know what I mean?
There'll be
nothing done.
Nobody's going to
work
for free.
So really, now we got to look at God.
Someone else.
You know?
No one. You're going to get what happened in Plymouth Rock when they tried to be communists when they got there. Remember? It was an utter failure. They almost starved to death. But when they went to free market economy, their economy and their lifestyle and their prosperity and their wealth boomed because they started trading amongst each other and with the Indians.
Yeah. Well,
I'm listening to people like AOC and Nancy Pelosi and almost every Democrat and some stupid Republicans who are trying to appease them, I guess. I don't know. But I listen to all these crazy people say the crazy, insane things they say. Then I look at the actual numbers that are actually hard numbers, baked-in numbers that we know to be pretty much true. And I hear their recommendations for it, and they got to be lunatics. The best we can do right now is hold this stuff at bay. Well, I don't know how we ever going to pay our way out of it. I don't even know if it's possible.
Well, there's something called a force majeure. You know, if you go into start looking into that, what they're going that's what I heard, and what it is you have to understand business bankruptcy and stuff like that, and then that's why you hear about the reset, the global reset. They'll reset the currencies. The changeover to a digital currency would wipe out all the debt that all the countries and all the people would have. Now, how many people would say, okay, my house is paid off. Oh, everything's paid off. All the debt's paid off if we switch over to digital. Come on, everybody will go for that in a second, right?
But wait a minute. So you're saying that your idea that the force majeure you envision is the United States just declaring bankruptcy or something?
Yeah, the entire world will. It'll be a force majeure. The entire world will be a global reset. and they'll reset the entire global economy to a digital or a cryptocurrency, and they'll get rid of paper currencies around the world.
Yeah.
And everybody will buy into it because what's
going to
happen is
you'll
have a global economic crash.
Yeah, I kind of thought about that too, but man, I got to say to myself, man, it's going to be some turmoil in this world if they ever take that. I mean, turmoil
but
like we may never
look
at, before at any time in human history.
Yeah, but Sarge, look, you got people locked down for this COVID thing, didn't they? The entire world locked down, you know? Now, I mean, yeah, you had people still out there driving around doing their thing and whatnot, but majority of people were locked in. You had people wearing masks at one time. You know, so why not? When it comes to money, now we're talking real serious money. People, you know, when it comes to money, you know people will get real serious. You know, that's your prized possession. So
man,
even more than children. To most people, not me, but, you know. It's crazy.
Yeah, well,
it's insane. It's insanity. So that's where you get into. Now you say, sorry, you got to get into the argument of it always reverts back to religion or God. What's your spiritual belief? What do you believe? You know, I mean, what's the creator? Is there a creator? You know, what's the end game plan? You know, what's it all about? And you start getting into those deep discussions. You know, people can't handle it, or they just can't cope with it, or you get different opinions that are just closed-minded people that just shut down, and they only have one way to believe, and they're not open to listening to anyone else. And I know we've just, you know, had that discussion already too, you and I. You know, so, you know, we have different people out there that believe a certain way, and there's just no way changing it. You're just not going to change it. So what do you do with those people? You know? I mean, it's all about control too, you know? I don't know. The answers are very difficult, but I can tell you right now, here in America, we're in trouble. I mean, what I was saying is there's no unity, there's no honesty, there's no work ethic anymore. Everybody's out to scam you. There's a backdoor secret. I mean, I'm not trying to preach all doom and gloom here and no hope, but if we don't wake up and figure something out and work together here and stop the silliness.
Well, Joe, how many times have we spoken of human nature? And how many times have we noticed and have we observed how the government takes the dictates of human nature and runs exactly contrary to it, particularly when you've got a leftist or Marxist type of government? What's happening now? You've got employers out there with decent jobs to give and people not willing to take them because the government has made it more profitable for them to stay at home than to take available jobs.
Yep.
See, that's what human nature is saying. Naturally, why should I go out and work hard when the government pays me more money to stay at home? See, when you ignore human nature and you create policies that are contrary to human nature, you always get bad results. That's what we're seeing now.
But who has the code? Who has the secret code to tickle everybody's ears to listen and make them realize? I would say there has to be the devil, the evil, you know.
So
some,
what they had to steal this election, Joe. There wasn't any way they were going to win this election unless they stole it. That's why they had to do it, so they could implement all this evil and do the great reset.
But look,
when everything collapses, then they can restructure it. They're prepared to ride it out.
And look at these Democrats. There's no talking to them. You can show them facts. Look, as a Trump supporter, I am. You can say, look, I know Trump did some things that were wrong, and I'm always willing to listen. If they can show me facts, okay, he did wrong. But you say something to a Democrat, anything that's on contrary to what they believe, if you show them facts, they just will not listen to it. They will not listen to it. They don't care. I don't care. It's my way, and that's it. And there's no appeasement to them. I mean, there's just not. There's no way to commit. And that's sad. That's something evil, something demonic, something spiritual that covers their eyes, you know, where they just don't see logic.
And we get glimpses of it from time to time when they are confronted with facts they don't want to acknowledge or even be presented with. They literally go into temper tantrums. They throw fits like little children who are on Ritalin. And, I mean, they're just utterly intractable and impossible. Have you seen lately what's popping up in the news with these hectoring, demagogic rants in public from these crazy people?
It's crazy.
I mean,
it's
popping
insanity
all over the place. There's just one big call to action. Action for action's sake.
They don't care. Kill Whitey. Kill this one. They don't care. It's insanity. You're absolutely right. It's insane.
It's worse.
I just don't see any hope.
Just think of it a little bit with the call, you and that caller we had about George Washington. Now, I'm not saying.
Oh, yeah, remember that one?
Yep. Yeah, I'm not saying the same. That's a perfect example of someone who can't take yes for an answer, literally. But I'm just saying that, you know, when you simply contest them, I'm talking about this kind of, just to contest it or call it in a question or ask for maybe a bit of a debate on the issue, they accuse you of attacking them.
Yep.
It literally is attacking because rather than present a coherent argument to counter it, they literally know they really can't. So they have to go on one of two paths. They have to go on insults, insulting you, or they have to go on a deflection path of saying, you said something to me, be so beyond the pale and so offensive, you shouldn't even say it.
Yeah.
And that's the way to shut down discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing it everywhere today. That's the whole point. The whole point behind censorship and cancel culture and all of this, it's all of a piece. And but look, one thing about this money, because this is simply mathematics. I mean, they just cannot put this off indefinitely and keep doing this. There are consequences in the long run, unless they figure they can get to the point where it collapses and they'll have their great reset in place so they completely restructure everything.
Or a war.
So, well, like
a
you
war.
Said,
now
with the digital money and everything else that they control, not Bitcoin, because Bitcoin they can't control, but a digital currency structure that they control and can centrally direct.
Yeah, that's right. Well, look at this, Israel back in the news again, what they're bombing over there again, you know, the Middle East, and we know, I know people don't believe in God, but God, you know, look, it describes it in the Bible. The Red Army comes down from the north and invades Israel, and God intervenes and stops it, and the Antichrist takes credit for it. And everybody worships the Antichrist, and that's where we get our one-world system. And, you know, everyone's crying for it. We got to have control. You know, I mean, there's just and the human trafficking men's souls. You know, the human trafficking that's going on around there. You know, I've touched upon this too, where I've exposed some of this stuff, and you know, I've been a target. You know, where let me tell you something. There's evil out there, pure evil, and. When the law is not on your side, or if the law is against you and the rule of law doesn't work anymore, there has to be a point and a time where you have to stand alone and you just sacrifice whatever is at that point of sacrifice that you have to sacrifice. Because, you know, if either you stand firm for what you believe in, we all want to live, but, you know, hey, death can't be that bad. You know, if there is a God, if there's not a God, then I just go to the ground and I don't know anything anyway, you know?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Joe. A long time I figured out, after almost having been killed on multiple occasions, I figured out I'm not getting out of this life alive, and I might as well find a hill worth dying on. Because I ain't getting out of this life alive no matter what I do. So, I mean, I don't care if everybody in the world either agrees with me or doesn't. I ain't changing my mind about anything until someone shows me a reason as to why I should. And if you don't, I'll never change my mind about anything. But if you do, I'll change
my mind.
Well,
you want facts. Yeah.
Yeah,
you want facts.
I want reason.
And you're willing to discuss any topic.
That makes sense.
Yeah, you're willing to discuss any topic and present the facts. But again, like you said, you have your conversations with these people, and you present the facts to them. And we've done it on this podcast so many times. You just mentioned one caller the other night where we did George Washington. Why ridicule George Washington? Nothing in that documentary was contrary to
him by the way that she claimed. Now, you know, I got four books about George Washington, highly regarded Pulitzer Prize-winning books. Four. One of them by Ron Chernow, Washington: A Life. I got another one by Gordon Woods. I got two others that are just about Washington. All together, they must be about 1,800 pages if you take off them. And then I got a lot of other books that deal with him peripherally as part of the Revolution. I went through all of them to see if I could. Maybe I forgot about this incident that she cited because it's significant if it happened. So I went through all of them where she claimed Washington almost drowned and looked bad in front of a lot of people. Remember? So I went back to see if I could find something that related to this. I could not find a single word. So then I went to the Mount Vernon webpage, and it's about dedicated to George Washington. And it says in that page, George Washington was a champion athlete. Had he been born in another time, he could have been a decathlete, like George Patton was, you know, in the Olympics.
Okay.
He was a champion archer. a champion equestrian. I mean, everybody talk about his ability to sit and control a horse. He was a great archer. He could hike for days on end. And they said he was a superb swimmer because, after all, he was a surveyor. He had to regularly cross rivers, build rafts, get across the river to make, like, rope lines to send the rafts across. They said he was a great swimmer. So now, and I'm not even going to say, based on that research I've just done, that what she's saying isn't true. Maybe something like it happened. But I'm telling you right now, I could find absolutely no evidence of it anywhere in my extensive research. And I got all these books, went on the line, see if I could find anything, but couldn't find anything.
Was she referring to, Sarge?
And I couldn't find anything about it.
Was she referring to when the Indian tried to kill him? Was it when the Indian guy tried to kill him? Wasn't that Andrew Jackson? Wasn't he going through
a guide or something? No, he was in the Indian War. He almost got killed at the Battle of Monongahela, when he was, had to take over when General Braddock was mortally wounded, and he had to organize a rear guard defense so the unit could get away. He had been sick with dysentery, and so he couldn't join the initial expedition. But when he recovered well enough, he was still kind of sick, but he wanted to do his duty. So despite being somewhat sick, he got up and rejoined the expedition. And as at that time, they got ambushed by a group of French troops with their Indian allies, and they would have been wiped out completely had it not been for the courage of Washington, who's just everywhere rallying the troops, organizing them, getting them in rear guard action. Bullets, he had two horses shot out from under him. Bullets are getting shot through his coat. It was witnessed by dozens and dozens of people, his actions on the battlefield, and including that Indian chief, who said one day he is going to be the chief of a great empire. And he was on the other side shooting at him.
Yeah.
Because
he was witnessing all the
things this man was doing.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, you know. And witness testimony is what we have to go by for testimony. And the thing of it is that, you know, if you have eyewitness testimony, I mean, it's just like us living. We have photographs of when we were children, you know. Have your testimony that you pass on down. Now, you know, and so if you have the core foundation of the facts. You know, now we all know stories can be diluted a little bit and padded or whatnot, but to back it up, you go by the record of your life. And George Washington, through the record of his life, was a great commander and brave. So obviously that story is false that she was saying, correct?
I'm forced to conclude that I think it's a lot of BS. I think it's created by people who want to deconstruct George Washington rather than admit his actual failings, which are also part of the record. He was a slave owner. Okay? He did go back and retrieve slaves who had escaped from his plantation. Okay? So, I mean, we had these flaws. We know about these flaws, and we can admit to them. And they're part of the record, and they should be discussed. I don't like it when people just make up balderdash about the guy trying to bring him down. Bring up his actual flaws. We can talk about them. We know about them.
Yeah. Sure.
He was human.
And every man has flaws.
He was a human
being. We all have flaws.
Yeah, all of
us
got them.
Yeah. I mean, come on. The only one I couldn't see had any flaws was Jesus Christ.
His attributes against his negatives, he was the greatest American in the history of the United States, okay? Period. End of story.
Definitely.
I ain't going to brook no other argument about that. That's my opinion.
Well, your opinion is fact, so it has factual foundation, so I'd say that's truth, and then truth that must be spoken, and that's why I put that documentary
out there. You know, the woke-topians, they don't want dissent. They want conformity. They demand conformity. They demand acquiescence, not just agreement. They want you to acquiesce to what they say.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Well, Sarge, I've got to get ready to wrap it up here. Anybody else who wants to jump in here real quick, you can. If not, I'm going to do the closing thoughts to the podcast here. We're winding down at 9 o'clock. They will cut me off about 4 minutes early, I think, because I started the show about 3 minutes early. So 657-380-0616, press 1. And the usual suspects, of course, I've been kicking you off every single night, and I'll continue to do that. We're not going to allow you on the podcast to disrupt the show. But I'll tell you what, that late night show, real quick there, I'll tell you what, we had success there late night, Sarge. I'm surprised you stayed awake with me that late. Well, we were up there at 2 o'clock in the morning. We had callers all up, and I had about 17 callers on the call board. I was like, I can't go all night.
You had all the insomniac cornered, man. You cornered the insomniac market. That's like me, man. I'm up that hour in the morning looking at stuff, too.
Yeah, yeah. I just figured I'd do a podcast. It was like 2 o'clock in the morning. I was like, the heck with it. You know, it was like 12:30 to 3 o'clock in the morning. And I had 17 callers, and they started getting 3 o'clock in the morning. I was like, oh, we're going to put an end to this. Because, you know, she called in, and then I think we had another caller that called in. And they were just, you know, they started getting into a debate. So I was like, you know, that can carry on for hours, the debate. You know, it takes away from the core foundation of what we're trying to do here is understand the times in which we live today. But, Sarge, any closing thoughts here real quick?
Well, you know, one thing, the closing thought I got is that, we are living in, as the Chinese say, and they didn't necessarily mean in a good way, we are living in very interesting times. Every day there's something tumultuous in the news. I mean, every single day. And the one thing we can look forward to tomorrow is more and more tumult. And in a way, that keeps your blood flowing and keeps you enervated, and maybe that ain't such a bad thing.
There you go. Well, I'll tell you what, I don't offer them my support anymore, but I'm going to go over to the NSM, because Bert does open phones on Wednesday, so I like to listen to his open phones, because that's you know, he's fair, and you know, I have the utmost respect for him. The other clowns, I don't, but, you know, the Bert, yes, so I'm going to go over to them and listen to what they have to say.
Oh,
I don't agree with a lot of
their... One other thing I think you ought to be aware of, and you ought to look at, go to the Gateway Pundit. There's a court... evidence in a court case in Georgia shows that Stacey Abrams oversaw staffing for the 2020 election in Georgia, specifically in Fulton County.
Really?
That's very interesting, if you ask me.
I'll look into that. We may talk about that tomorrow night, I think, maybe. I think that's what we'll do. So anybody else who's
look
got something they want to...
Look, funded right now.
Yeah, I'll definitely bring by maybe look into that for the next podcast. But anybody who's got something they want to add, do it now, 657-383-0616. We are winding down the show to people in the chat room. Who was in the chat room tonight, Sarge, real quick? I saw New Orleans Wake Up was in there. Gavin, there we go. And this is what we're talking about there. We got Gavin Moorhead, and he's got nothing, obviously, to say, and the chat room usually, a lot of people have ran away from the chat room because they don't want to look at that perverted nonsense and that disgusting nonsense, but, you know, I understand why you stay in there. Keep, they got good content in there, so thanks, Sarge, for that. I appreciate it. All right, I guess we're going to wrap it up here tonight. God bless the Republic. Oh, my grandmother, I forgot. My grandmother's listening tonight. She listened the entire show. So when we did dedicate a song to her in the beginning, we played a good there, Oreo Speedwagon, and thanks for listening there to my grandmother. I'm not going to say her name because I can't, because we got so many whack jobs out there that listen to this show, but thanks for listening, and I'll say God bless the Republic and good night.